My name is Keith, and I'm an alcoholic.
And
I'm grateful to be here tonight and grateful to be sober. I want to thank Myra and the committee and Chris for inviting me. What a privilege and an honor it is to be here. I'm a little bit loopy, actually, tonight. I got up early this morning. I was in Miami and flew out here and then drove straight up. So I'm usually loopy. I'm really loopy, so we'll see it. But honestly, it was great to get here and just get to a couple meetings. I was at a work conference for a few days, which is just not really my cup of tea. Like a lot of alcoholics, I'm kind of antisocial in my own way. You know, I stand away from everybody and then resentful at them for not coming and talking to me. But it's amazing to me also about Alcoholics Anonymous. I will say this, if you're new or relatively new, you know, one of the things I'm the most grateful for is I know what my problem is. You know, my problem is alcoholism. And I'm grateful that I know what my problem is, and even more grateful that I know what my solution is. Because just coming here and getting to a few meetings, I just felt a lot better. The old-timers panel was great. I've gone to some old-timers panels where they can go a couple different directions. But today was awesome. They were really good, you know. And then I really, I don't know if Corey's here, but the H&I panel was, or the H&I speaker was awesome. He did a great job. Actually, I did think it was a little bit funny because there was a few people up on stage, and of like the three or four guys that were sitting up here, if you would have said which one of them had a shootout with the police, I would not have picked Corey. I mean, he looked like he was doing like an IRS tax audit class or something in the joint, you know, and it's like... But what a great story. And then, you know, Allie was just amazing, man. I swear, she just gave such a great talk at the young people's. Actually, the first thing I noticed about the young people's meeting that I really liked is everybody up on the panel was young, which I always appreciate. Because one of my very first conventions I went to, I was young. I was like 18 years old. And I walked in the room at a conference. It was a young people's meeting. And some guy was up there right about my age with about as much hair as I have. And he was like, young isn't an age, it's a feeling. And I remember thinking, no, young is an age. You know, like, sorry, buddy. I just thought it was like so creepy. So I'm always a little careful rolling into the young people's meeting, you know. What a great talk Allie was giving. And then I was sitting back there with my brother, Kevin, and, you know, it's like nobody cries like amen, you know. And she was, I was like trying to hide the fact that I was crying. I look over and Kevin's like... You know, it was like, what a great talk you gave. So it's just, I'm just really grateful to be here and, you know, just going to tell my story, sad and pathetic as it is, and try not to lie or exaggerate. And like I said, I'm really grateful to be here. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I'm proud to say every member of my immediate family has identified themselves in AA as an alcoholic. And, I don't know if that made me more or less likely to be an alcoholic. The only thing I'll say about our house growing up, it was just very intense. And not all intense bad. Anybody who's grown up in like an really active alcoholic home, you know what I'm talking about. It's just very intense. Intense good, some intense bad, but just all intense. And as far back as I can remember, I felt uncomfortable in my own skin. I felt at dis-ease. I just felt uncomfortable about me. I shouldn't say about me. I just felt uncomfortable, and I felt like I was just thinking about myself all the time. I was always just measuring what people were thinking or what I thought they were thinking about me. I was always just, as far back as I can remember, and I felt uncomfortable and at dis-ease. And I felt bad about myself, and like in hindsight, I think there was some reasons that was justified. Like, first of all, I was like a dirty, filthy kid. I just never liked to bathe. I was disgusting. I just stunk all the time. I was one of those kids. I taught school in sobriety, and there's always that one kid who just can't get it together, man. And I was that kid. And I know this isn't like Dirty People Anonymous. It has nothing to do with alcohol. I know. But the reason I bring it up is I felt terrible about that. I really felt bad about it, and for some reason, I couldn't do anything about it. And I wet the bed. I may as well just get it all out there tonight up in here in Ventura. I know, no big deal. Everybody wets the bed, but I was wetting the bed like way after you're supposed to stop. And there's any other bed wetters in here, you know what that means. You just got one of those plastic undersheets. There's always one person in the thank you line gives you the big bro hug, like, me too, man. You know, like, but... Which, again, is no big deal, has nothing to do with AA, except I felt bad about it. And really, that's not a big deal, except every once in a while, you spend the night at a friend's house and wet their couch or something. That's kind of a bummer. But, you just, alcoholics, I think, at an early age learn to just adapt. You just turn that pillow over and, you know, they'll figure it out later. But, but I always felt uncomfortable in my own skin, as far back as I can remember. And my big outlet as a family and my big outlet was sports. I just was a sports craze. We were a sports craze house. I was just crazy about sports. And I found kind of like my love when I was like 11 years old. My dad was a really good golfer. I played all different sports, but at the same time, I really started having problem at team sports. I kind of fell in love with golf, and it was around 11 years old. And I had these dreams that I was going to play golf like at UCLA. I was going to college and I wanted to go to UCLA, and I was really serious about it, actually. I mean, I was very serious about it, and I worked really, really hard. And I just, like that alcoholic, you know, that drive, I just definitely had that. And that competitiveness. And I actually swore off drinking. I was never going to drink, and I was never going to do drugs. And then that changed, obviously. I had a friend who was a little bit older than me. His name was Robbie Lawson. And I know somebody else said earlier, we're not supposed to diagnose other people's alcoholic. But I secretly believe he was an alcoholic. Because he was like, hey, Keith, this guy, his mom's out of town this weekend, and we're going to go over to your house, we're going to get drunk. And I was like, Robbie, I don't do that. He's like, no, you just have to trust me. And I said, dude, no. And he goes, no, I know you've heard some bad things about it, but you just have to trust me. And I personally believe non-alcoholics, like, aren't that fired up about it. And so he's like, so we went over to this guy's house. And it's kind of funny when I look back at it. I also was a liar and a cheat and a thief and a chisel and a mooch. And I never had a lot of friends. And I was a bully. I was also this big kid. I was kind of like Baby Huey, you know. I was just this big kid. And I was mean. Bullying now is not in. Not that it was ever, I guess, in. But I was like, now it's like this big crime. But I was this horrible, horrible bully. And so I didn't endear myself to a lot of people, but I always had a couple close friends, and I was really loyal to those friends for the most part, and he was one of them. And I think in hindsight, I kind of looked up to this guy. He was a little bit older than me. He played in a band. He was really a talented musician. He was one of those kids who like had a girlfriend like really young, and I could not talk to girls at all. I was just scared. Fear, I was just scared to death of him. And he convinced me to take my first drink. And I still remember really clearly, we went to this guy's house, and he poured some vodka, he poured some orange juice, I'm going to date myself a little bit, because like in the 70s, there was a lot of like glassware that was like brown and tan and orange. It was just hideous. All the older people like me are like, yep, I remember. And he handed me this glass, and it was like filled with mostly vodka and some orange juice. And I remember sniffing it, and he said, you got to drink it fast. Which is another sign, but anyways. And so we drank enough of that stuff down, and the effect alcohol had on me was immediate. You know, I've thought about that a lot. Like, I was like 14 years old at that time, and I drank for about 5 years, and I've been sober for 32 years. And my reaction to alcohol that day defined my life, really. Because I had problems when I was a kid. It went beyond just being a slob and a dirty kid. I was also one of those kids that was just like off. You know, I used to go around the hate, and I love reading these books about serial killers and stuff. And then one day it dawned on me, like, my God, I had like some of those weird, crazy traits. I'd go around the neighborhood, like, here, kitty, kitty, kitty. And I would just like, kick. Oh, the AA crowd is judging me. It's like, oh, yeah. I swear, someone will be like, oh, I ran over this family, and I killed 15, and everyone's like, oh, you know, it's like, you hurt an animal, everyone's like, get him, you know. And I remember, like, I found this potato bug one time in our backyard, and I was, like, ripping the legs off it one at a time, and then it just died, of course, and I just started crying. I don't know what, like, something's just wrong with me, you know. So I thought about that. There's a lot of people who, when they drink enough alcohol, they don't have the same reaction that alcoholics do. And I think about that, I'm so thankful. Because if I didn't have that reaction, I can't imagine the messed up life that I would have lived. But the reaction I had was immediate. And it was impactful in my life. And it was like, I knew from that very first time that I drank, I knew what, I'm going to steal a line from Hank Jay, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to drink. I was like, this is it. Like, I found something. And if you're new tonight, I have some great news for you. And I have some horrible news for you. And the great news is Alcoholics Anonymous works. It really, really works. You might be new like I was and be sitting here. I know somebody mentioned earlier they felt home. I think in the old timers meeting, somebody mentioned that they felt home when they came to AA. I did not feel home when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not feel like this was the place for me. And if you're new tonight and you feel like that, welcome. But I want you to know Alcoholics Anonymous works. That's the great news. The bad news is, in my experience, it doesn't work like drinking. I love drinking. I love feeling good, like, right now. I love things like that. That's why I love stealing. It was like, mine. Like, I don't have to save. I don't have to wait. I love feeling good, like, right now. And alcohol did that for me. I just couldn't believe that you could feel that good that fast. I'll tell you what alcohol, I mean, I could describe it a lot of different ways, and I've heard it described so many different ways, and I identify with all of them, but this is what alcohol did for me. This is the best way that I know in my experience that I could tell you what the effect that alcohol had and why it was so important to me. I hated school growing up. I mean, hate is an understatement. I hate sitting still in classes. I hate having to do what I'm told. In the majority of classrooms I had growing up, I had a segregated part of the classroom where the classroom would be there and I would be in the back. The teacher would build a partition. As a matter of fact, not that I hold on to anything, but my very first day of school in fourth grade, my teacher was named Miss Puffer. She was a bitch, actually, if you want to know the truth. If we're being honest. But the very first day of fourth grade, I walk in and she's going through the roll book, O'Brien, Prendergast, and she pointed to the supply room door closet. And I'm like, what? Like, what? That's the closet. She's like, that's where your desk is this year, Mr. Prendergast. And I was just like, it was the first day. Like, what could I possibly have done? But actually, I had a pretty good year that year. A little more structure kind of helped me out. But so I hated school, and as I got older, it got worse and worse and worse. I'm not saying I would ever do anything like some of these people, like, you know, bring guns. I'm not saying I would do anything like that. I'm just saying I understand the hatred that goes into some of those acts, to be honest. I hated school, and then it got to high school, it was even worse, with all the cliques and the jocks and the people, because I didn't fit, like Allie mentioned, I didn't fit in anywhere. I just didn't fit in anywhere. It was clear I was the only drunk stoner on the golf team, I guarantee you that. And when I started, by the time I was done, I had converted a couple guys. But anyways, anyways, this is what alcohol did for me. Hate school. I mean, just can't stand any of it. So one day in high school, this is right after I started drinking. And for me, what happened with my drinking is I started drinking at every opportunity I could. But the opportunities didn't present themselves that often initially. And then I started making them happen. But in that period where the opportunities weren't coming around very often, a girl asked me, her name was Heidi. She said, hey, do you want to ditch third period? And I was like, sure. I mean, I would do anything a girl asked me to do, to be honest. And she said, I snuck in some whiskey for my parents. I was like, sweet. So we go across the street, or we leave campus, get a little bit buzzed, and this is what alcohol does for me. I'm walking back across campus, and I have just enough of that alcohol in me to produce that change that it talks about in the doctor's opinion. And now I'm walking across campus, and I'm listening to for our younger members, I'm listening to something called a Walkman, which was a listening device. Like, there's somebody over there who's like three who's got Beats by Dre on over there. But I was listening to a Walkman, which played these things called cassettes, which played music. And this is when MTV became like big with music videos. And I was walking across campus with just enough of that magic, just enough alcohol in me to produce the magic that alcohol does in me. And I was thinking that I was so cool listening to this song that I could be the music video for the song that I was listening to. And here's the thing, is it wasn't just me. I was thinking about what, you know, the whole school, all of us, that we were so cool together. And now, mind you, hate, and I got enough alcohol and it's like love, love, love. And what I didn't know is that that doesn't do that for non-alcoholics. You know, I don't know if that guy who gave my first drink was an alcoholic. When I was 60 days sober, I ran into his mom in like the most freak coincidence. I was driving my mom's car and I came to a stop sign. They had moved to Oregon years before that. And his mom was just crossing the street. And I was like, Mrs. Lawson? And she came up to my car window, and she looked terrible. I said, how you doing? She said, I'm fine. I said, oh, how's Robbie? She said, he's fine. And I was like, okay. And then she said, he's not fine. And she said, we got a call late last night. He died in a car accident. He was driving drunk. And I don't know if he was an alcoholic really, but I believe that we had the same relationship to alcohol. And what that relationship was for me was that over a very quick period of time, my alcoholism progressed rapidly. Within a year, I was drinking almost every day. Within a year and a half, I was definitely drinking every day. And within 2 years, I was putting some in my system morning, noon, and night. And it was like the times without putting some alcohol or something in my system just became unacceptable rapidly. And I just started making it happen, and my life just completely changed. Just absolutely and completely changed. Then I was like a couple years into my drinking, and my brother got sober, Kevin, who's right there. And I'm not here to tell his story, but it just happens to be part of my story. But he got sober. And I had, to be honest with you, I had no problem with him getting sober. I knew something was really wrong with him from long before he ever drank. He needed help. Anyone who knows Kevin would not argue with that. But but what happened was, and I don't know if anyone has experienced this, but I went, after he got sober, I went to a meeting to give him a cake. And I don't know, you know, they talk about like drinking that's fun, and then fun with problems, and then all problems. I don't know if anyone's ever gone to an AA meeting during the fun only period, but I had the pleasure of doing that, and I was like appalled. I mean, I was like, somebody, they're like, oh, I didn't even know we're doing like going to give him a cake. I was like, well, we just go to Vaughn's and get a cake. What do you, I don't like, what is it? But I was like, whatever. And so we go and we give him a cake, and they're like, happy birthday. I was like, are you serious? They're like gonna sing? And then this guy got up and took a cake for like 4 years. And I was like, 4 years? I was like fixated on that guy. And I was thinking like, that guy still has to go to meetings after 4 years? And I was like, that's not something that should be acknowledged at a group level. I mean, that's some level of weakness that I just did not know was existed in the universe. You know, I was like, wow. But anyways, to back up, he ended up getting sober. And I had no problem with him getting sober because he went off the deep end. He was like dealing LSD. And we lived in this upper middle class area in Redondo Beach. And he started going on bad trips to LSD. And I'm not here to make light of that because some people don't ever come back from him. And he was very close to it. But it was like at 3 a.m. Everybody get up. Everybody get up. And we all come out to the living room. It was like, what? And he's like, I'm Jesus. He's like, I was like, now let me just set the scene for you. Because Kevin was like a hardcore punk rocker. So it's not like he was wearing a robe and had a staff or something. He was dressed like a hardcore punk rocker is. Shaved head, you know, and just like, and I was just like, Kevin, I'm pretty sure you're not the Messiah. You know, it's like, and then it was like, my parents, first generation European, they were kind of cool with us, like drinking, and like, it was just different, you know, and then he started like bumming that out, you know, and as a matter of fact, one time my dad was like, my mom was out of town, and my dad was trying to play it all cool. He goes, yeah, you know, I'd smoke pot if you guys had some, and all three of us were like, well, dad, you're in luck. He was like, whoa, it's like, we all happen to be holding, dad, let's get it on, but anyway, so now they were like, what's going on? And they took him to the hospital. And then he's like, I'm never doing that again, but I'm going to keep dealing. Well, you know how that goes. You know, it's like 3 weeks later, 3 a.m, everybody get up. It was always like in the middle of the night. He never transformed into Jesus during that noon. But the third time I was hot, I was pissed because I was like, he's like bumming my deal out. Because then my parents are like, something else is going on here. This is really weird. But that night, he grabbed his car keys, and I remember my mom's like, oh, my God, he got his keys. And I literally was like, I don't care. I don't care. And he jumped in his car, and he drove his car into this house doing 100 miles an hour because we lived on this hill. And I'll tell you, Norm Alpe used to talk about, or Seth, actually, he was long dead when I got sober, but I heard tapes of him about seconds and inches. And he ended up hitting the corner of this house and knocking the entire house off its foundation. Had his car literally been, like, that much further over, he would have gone right through this wall and killed this baby that was sleeping there. And that would have forever changed our lives. I think about that a lot because I feel so fortunate. We're so fortunate. But he ended up getting going into this place, Del Amo Hospital. And the reason that was kind of, it was just, I mean, I will say, I don't know if anyone has been to family therapy with four practicing alcoholics and one who's brand new sober, but it was priceless. I mean, it was beautiful. I mean, that doctor did the best. His name was Dr. Lurie. He did the best he could with what he had, I suppose. But it was awesome. I mean, I would give anything for, like, videotapes of those sessions. I mean, anything. Because the first week, he's on my dad. Now, my dad, mind you, was this crazy Irish flash temper, just handle, you know, just beat the crap out of us. He'd go after other kids. And I mean, he was just crazy. He pulled a shotgun on a, I mean, people were scared of my dad. You know, he had to do sleepovers with families and stuff. People, my friends would come sleep over once and they would never want to come over again. They'd be scared that my friend would be like, I couldn't sleep, man. I thought your dad was going to come out and kill me or whatever. And my dad was crazy. So the first week they're on him about his drinking and they're like, Keith, why don't you tell your dad about how his drinking has affected you? And my dad's looking at me like, yeah, you little son of a bitch. Like, go ahead, fire away. And I'm like, I don't think it's a good idea, Dr. Lurie. You know, he'll kill us all, you know. And then, and my mom, who's like this nice Dr. Jekyll, Mrs. Hyde, by day, she's like the sweetest woman. She's from, lived here and moved from Switzerland like 50 years ago, but she still has this really strong accent. And she's like, goes rescue stray cats and dogs during the day, feeds the homeless. And at night, she just turns into this mean drunk, you know. And so the first week, she loved him. She's like, I really like, you know, and then the next week, they're on here about her drinking, and she stormed out of there. He's like, he's a real nosy son of a bitch, you know, that is like. And then the next week, they're on my brother, Chris, who some of you may know, he lives up here. And they were, the doctor was like, Chris, do you think you could go 2 weeks without drinking? He's like, sure. And then he couldn't. And that really messed with him, which to me, I find so funny. This is the type of guy I am. Like, the next week, I come rolling in. Like, I'm not an idiot. I know where this is going. And I'm like, Dr. Lurie, before you get started, I just want you to know, since Kevin's been here this last 3.5 weeks, I decided to support him, so I haven't been drinking or using at all. And he's like, he's just lapping it up. He's like, that's wonderful, Keith. And my Chris was like, because we were in the parking lot drinking Foster's, tall cans, and smoking a joint, like, man, I really like therapy sessions, you know. It's like, I just felt like I could be more myself in there if I was like, and that's the type of guy I am. Like, truth means nothing to me. I mean, integrity, nothing. It means nothing. Like, Kevin had a super strong conscience about things. He would never do any drugs around me. He was just, but I, like, and I literally got arrested the next day. It was just the funniest thing, you know. Anyway, so my alcoholism progressed really rapidly, and I just, but it was still, I'll tell you the craziest thing about being an alcoholic for me, and this is in sobriety, is I think things are going this way when they're actually going this way, and I think I'm doing fine. I think I'm doing fine, and I thought I was doing fine. You know, I've heard people say, like, alcohol gave me the, you know, feeling of a job well done without doing a damn thing. And I experienced that. I thought that, I mean, I'm a daily drinker now, and I'm putting something in my system the first thing in the morning, all day, and the last thing I do at night, I'm putting something in my body that affects me from the neck up. And I still just thought that UCLA was going to send me a letter, they're going to, golf coach is going to call me, that it was just going to all work out. I just thought I'm going to just, you know. But then there were signs that clearly it wasn't working out, that maybe something was happening. I remember, now, mind you, I am extremely competitive, and I love, like, athletic competition. I still, to this day, I coach basketball. I coach girls basketball, and I'm a madman. I don't coach one team, of course. I coach, like, six teams, you know. And it's like, back at that time, when I tell you that those golf matches at my school meant the world to me, believe me when I tell you they did. And I still thought, it was still kind of hanging on. I showed up for the biggest match of the year, my junior year, drunk. And I'm telling you, there is no way I would have let that happen. It meant so much to me. I was the captain of the team. I was the best player on the team. The coach let me just basically run the team. And I'll never forget standing there, and the guys on my team, like, going, are you drunk? Like, there's no way. We were having a good year. We had a chance to do something we had never done before. And I showed up to the, it's exactly like it talks about in the big book, like getting tied at exactly the wrong moment. So there were signs that things were, that maybe things weren't going the way that I thought they were. But I still just was blown right past those, you know. I remember talking to my dad about going to college. Well, I'm thinking to apply to go to colleges. And he was like, are you joking? Are you, you're serious? And he called my mom over, Regina, listen to this. And they both started laughing. I'm like, I've worked so hard. You know, it's such a joke. Like I thought, and he's, I remember, I'll never forget him saying, I'm not going to pay for you to go drink in college for 4 years. Are you joking? You know, and so I, now I'm playing the victim to everybody. Oh, my dad, he's not going to pay for my college. Unbelievable. And I'll tell you something, because I don't know if anyone else felt like this. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt so alone. I felt like nobody had been there for me. You know, that alcoholic loneliness it talks about. But the crazy part about the alcoholic loneliness is I was doing it to myself. I was pushing everybody away by my actions. But I just thought nobody had been there for me, which is such a joke. There were parents, other like friends' parents, my parents, teachers, coaches begging me. Like begging, Keith, what are you doing? Because when I first started, I mean, we were known in our area as like troublemakers, but I did really well when I was a freshman. It's just like Bill Wilson talks about, money and applause came out. It wasn't money and applause, but I did really well in school and I did really well in golf. And it was like, I kind of felt like I had it figured out. But by the time I was like a junior or senior in high school, clearly things were like falling apart. I remember the dean of my high school, they were always pulling me in to search me because they thought I was dealing drugs, which I never did successfully at all. And so, but this particular day, they pulled me in and they're like, search him. And I'm like, go ahead. And then this particular day, I'd been up for like 3 days. And when you've been up for 3 days, it's pretty obvious you've been, you know, something, like you're not on the top of your game. And I was sitting there all smug because I didn't have anything on me. Like, go ahead, search me. And then she said, look at you. Look at you. And she started crying. She said, you were doing so well. Don't you see it? Don't you see what's going on? And I went from being all smug to just like, oh my God, just get me out of here. You know, that look that we get. And she wasn't even somebody close to me, you know. And then I was telling all my friends' parents, oh, my dad's not going to pay. And then this one family that I'd known a long time, they pulled me aside. The mom did and said, hey, George and I were talking about it. And you go down to Dominguez Hills, Cal State Dominguez Hills, and you apply, and we'll take care of your tuition and your books. And if your parents won't let you stay there, you could stay with us because Dave's going off to college. And I was like, wow, really? That's like so nice. Yeah. And she goes, but go down there and get that application. I said, okay. And the next time I saw her, she's like, did you get that application? I said, oh, no, but I will tomorrow. I'm going tomorrow for sure, you know. It's always tomorrow with me because today I'm busy. And the next time I saw her, she's like, here. She went and got me the application. And that application, which only asked for my personal information, sat in my room like a 10,000-pound weight. Like I was incapable of filling it out, you know. And I never did. And what happened is I got kicked off the golf team my senior year for drinking. And I was the only one who was really surprised. Nobody else was really surprised about that. But then all of a sudden, the reality of what was going on. I have a good friend of mine who always says, the waiter always brings the check. And it's like, you can act the way, like, but sooner or later, the consequences of your actions are going to catch up. Or they did for me. And when I got kicked off the golf team, I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And there's a line in Bill's story that says, alcohol ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And that's exactly kind of what happened. Up to that point, I'd been drinking, but I quit caring about saving face anymore. And I started doing crazier and crazier things to stay drunk and loaded all the time. I started breaking into cars in the neighborhood and breaking into houses. And I don't want to paint the wrong picture here. I hate when people badden up their stories in AA to try. You know, I'll tell you the type of badass I was. That day I got arrested, you know, my dad, I was always like, wanting my mom to come pick me up because my dad would kind of cause a scene. I don't know if anyone grew up with a dad like that where they beat. I don't like taking a beating, but I don't like taking a beating in front of people, you know. So this one time I'm hoping, you know, and then actually to fast forward into sobriety, I was teaching school and these kids called in a bomb threat because they didn't want to take a math test, which I totally understand. That makes sense. And they somehow, somebody buckled by 10 o'clock. They knew who it was. And this was right after Columbine. And all these kids got expelled from the district. It was a math honors class in middle school. And every kid had been picked up. There was one kid sitting in the office still. And his dad came in and in one bound went through the office into the principal's office and just knocked his kid out of the chair. And everyone was like, you know, I had to call my dad. I was like, I love you, Dad, man. I mean, like, that brought back some memories, you know. I was like, so I'm always hoping mom's going to pick me up. But this one particular time, of course, my dad comes up. I'm like, shit, you know. And so, but luckily we got away from the police. And then he's like, who sold you this? And he was still like in the stage of like maybe thinking it was somebody else's fault or somebody else had a bad influence on me or something. And I was like, and he pulled the car over. He's like, I'm going to kick your ass until you tell me. And he grabbed me and I was like, it was Chris, my brother. You know, I was like, that's the type of badass I was. You know, I was just some 2-bit punk, like I just such a weasel. I was such a little weasel. I would go to parties and just start going through people's stuff, their family's house, and just steal stuff like they didn't even need, like a jacket, you know. And I would get shamed out of parties, you know, because I was just such a nuisance, you know. But so what happened is I turned 18 and I got arrested for theft again. I'd always been on this like kiddie probation or whatever, which was nothing, and I got arrested for theft. And then the last time I got arrested, to tell you what a fine, upstanding citizen I was, it was for strong-arming some woman for a purse in the middle of the day. Myra, really? This is not funny. This is the tragic part of my story. She hasn't laughed at one thing I said. She's like... Was she old? Did you hurt her? It's like, Jesus, man, what is the matter with you? Yeah. She's like, we have a lot of questions. I bet you do. I don't think we have a lot of questions. I think you have a lot of questions. Anyway, so, and I'll tell you, I'll say this. I hope I never forget. I have a really good life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a really good life. But I don't ever want to forget the way that I was living before I got to AA. I mean, and it's easy to forget. I swear, anybody who's been sober a little while, it's easy to forget, you know. The only thing that really brings it back is in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. You know, when I see somebody come in the room who's living the way that I was living before I, you know, when I got here. And I don't ever want to forget. And to be honest with you, it's not even like these big high, you know, things that happen, these big or low lights, you know. It's like, it's not even that. The great majority of my drinking, the last couple years of my drink, and I mean the great majority, was in my room by myself. You know, like it says in A Vision for You, a slave to King Alcohol. You know, I knew exactly what that meant. You know, I remember one of the first speakers I heard was a woman I had nothing in common with. I mean, they said, listen for the similarities when you get here. I was incapable. I'd be like, nope, nope. But this one woman spoke. She was born and raised in Harlem, you know, African-American. I had nothing in common with her. But she talked about what it was like in those awful hours in the morning. And she described it, and I was like I had been where that woman had been. And that started to happen to me when I was new in alcoholism. What happened actually is I went to see this lawyer because I was in a lot of trouble. You know, I wasn't like gonna serve a life sentence or anything, or I wasn't shooting at cops, but I was in a lot of trouble for me. I thought I'm going to jail for a year. I just thought I'm going to, a year, and I did not want to go to jail for a year. And I went to see this lawyer. I had played golf with his son in high school, and he'd always been really kind to me, this guy. And I kind of talked to him about what had happened, that I had been partying a lot, and I was doing kind of crazier and crazier than this. And that. I was talking about it like it was a jaywalking ticket, like, hey, what do you think? But to be honest, when the Good Samaritans in Redondo Beach make a citizen's arrest on you, there's not really much to talk about. Like, you can't say I was framed by the cops or something. And I just kind of told him, and he was sitting back there. He had this kind of look on his face, like almost like he knew I'd be coming to see him someday. It was kind of weird. But he said, well, that's not unusual behavior for an alcoholic. And I was like, I was a little taken back. I didn't say it to him, but I was thinking like, Sid, I've actually been to an AA meeting. And I'm, you know, I might be a purse snatcher, but I'm not an alcoholic, for Christ's sake. Like, I haven't stooped that low, you know. I was like, but it turns out Sid was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll say something about that I think about a lot. This guy was really kind to me. I had known him for a while. His, you know, he was a member of Palos Verdes Country Club. His kid used to play in these tournaments, and he kind of took an interest in me. And he would he reached out to help me on numerous occasions. He got me into this tournament, these tournaments, all these country club kids and me. I remember one time I won one of them. I played really well, and I won one of them. And he, I looked up. He had tears in his eyes. He was so happy for me. And I've thought about that a lot. Like, I didn't know that guy was in AA. But that day when he invited me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, he had been a living example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not trying to preach to anybody up here or say, you should do this or you should do that. Like, hey, we're just trying to get another day. I'm just trying to get another day of sobriety in around here. You know, that's why, you know, I show up here. But I do think about that. Like, if somebody that I work with or somebody that I interact with, if they found out that I'm in AA, I hope that I try and conduct myself in a manner that, like he did. And he asked me if I wanted to meet him that night at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said yes. I skateboarded to that meeting on a skateboard I'd bought with a stolen credit card, and I was wearing a pair of sneakers that I'd bought with a different stolen credit card. And I just sat in the back, and it was the foot stompers in Redondo Beach, where they stomped their feet where they when they clapped. And there was just a lot of energy in the room, and I just was like, what the hell is going on, man? I was confused. You know, if you're new and your primary feeling is just confusion about being here, welcome. You know, there are some people who think you have to know tonight. Are you an alcoholic? Are you convinced your innermost, you know, I was not convinced to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic until I was 2 years sober. I was 18 and a half years old. When I got here, I was broken in every way possible, just about that you could be. And I didn't think I was home. I didn't know what was going on. Everybody just seemed way too happy to be here. Like, how you doing? How you really doing? It's like, it just felt so phony. Like, I don't know about anybody else, but it just felt like you can't, you don't, I don't even, like if you burst into flames and you were burning to death, I probably would try and help you, but I wasn't like that invested in you. Like, you couldn't be that concerned about how I'm doing, some stranger. But I'll tell you something that I found out that actually became an attraction to me. To me, because I was so sick and twisted. I don't have quite the dark humor that Allie does, but I'm close. But I'll tell you something that I loved about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, people always say, like, the new person who walks in off the room, they're the most important person in this room. It's like, there's not an old-timer in AA that thinks that anybody who walks off the street is more important than them. I guarantee you. But here's the deal. The truth of the matter is people weren't that interested in me. And that was an attraction to me. What I mean by that is that they, and our literature could not be more clear. If you're not an alcoholic or you don't think you're an alcoholic and you want to drink again, we encourage you to. And it's not like, oh, you will be here when you get back. You may not be an alcoholic. I don't know. But here's the deal. And this was an attraction to me. My entire life, I don't know about anybody else, but I sat in front of people and they said, Keith, don't do this, do this. Don't steal, do this. Don't slap that girl, do this. Whatever it was like, I do what I want to do. That's my only prerequisite. Do I want to do it, and can I get away with it? And one thing that was an attraction to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody was trying to convince me to stay here against my will. What they were and they weren't that interested in me, but what they were interested in finding out was, is my life not working? Can I not stop drinking? And most importantly, do I want to do something about it? And then if that's the case, my experience is, we'll do anything for you. If you're new and you want to do something about your drinking and your life isn't working, we will do everything for you to help you stay sober. And I mean, there was three old timers when I was new that took an interest in me and saved my life. I will never be able to repay that debt to those three guys. One guy had like 48 days. The other guy had like 67. And this other guy had like more than 90 days. I was like, dang, 90 days without a drink? Like, are you kidding me? I remember somebody took me to Norm's restaurant and I had a calendar. My first day of sobriety was a Saturday. And then I got 7 days, and I was in the next week, and I couldn't believe it, that I hadn't had a drink in like 8 or 9 days. I couldn't believe it. And those three guys did so much for me. They all lived in San Pedro, which is like in the harbor area. Or my first home group was a morning meeting, which was in Harbor City, which is 5 minutes away from San Pedro. And they came and drove like 25 minutes to pick my sorry ass up and in like Hollywood Riviera, which is 25 minutes away, and then 25 minutes back to this morning meeting, Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. Never one time did I get the call, dude, I'm just making the 5-minute drive today. Every day they got my sorry ass to that meeting. And I will never be able to repay that debt. Then they ended up helping, one of them helped me get into a recovery house in San Pedro. Come to think of it, he's probably just trying to shorten his commute. But anyways, I will say this. Recovery house is not mandatory, but it was a big deal for me. I learned so much in that recovery house because they spoke in a language that I understood. They'd be like, Keith, like new business, the chairman would be like, dude, your room stinks. Do your laundry. Clean your stuff up, you know. And they would just move on. And I would be like, wait, hold on. Can I say a few words? I was like, I don't know if there's any other explainers in here tonight, but it turns out nobody cares why you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. And I mean nobody. And they made me get a job, and then they made me get a sponsor, and they made me be self-supporting. And that completely changed my life. You know, I don't know about anyone else, but I didn't want to get a sponsor. Some guy would be up at the, be sharing like, I wanted to date this girl, but my sponsor said no. And I was like, I don't know if I like the sponsorship idea, you know. And then, so I was like, but they made me get a sponsor. And so I asked this guy to be my sponsor. I never would have asked him if I knew. It turns out he was gay. He was in the closet. In San Pedro in 1989, there was not a lot of guys out, I promise you. And he was dating one of the guys in the house. I was just too, like, oblivious to realize. And so I asked this guy to be my sponsor. And I tell you something, some of my fondest memories are going to that guy's house and working the steps and learning what alcoholism is and going through that book with him. And I remember it was weird, though. It was just weird, like going to his house and we're like reading these stuff. And then he's like, okay, we're going to get down on our knees. And I was like, wait, what did you just say? It was like, I'm not falling for that one again. Like, no way, you know. And then he was like, but then like doing the third step with him, and then he explained what that meant. And then like, doing my fifth step with him. I had thought I was like a pretty good guy. Like, I literally was like, I think I'm a pretty good guy. When I read that inventory to him, I was like, I am the biggest piece of crap. Like, I had never been honest. I had never been decent. I had never been upfront. I had never done anything for anybody else except myself. I had everybody who had come across my path, I had used and abused. Everybody. And I felt horrible. And then, like Allie was talking about, I went back that hour this recovery house in the garage, and I sat there and just like, I was just doing something that was completely against my nature. And recovery, the process just was extremely slow. It felt extremely slow. You know, I ended up just starting to go back to school. I put myself through school, went full-time or part-time school and worked full-time because they made me get a job. I was like, oh, now that I'm sober, I'm going to build my empire. You know, turns out, not so much for me. It was a little slow. My first job was pumping gas at a gas station, and I worked there for my first 3.5 years of sobriety. And things were just extremely slow. You know, if you're new, I hope you get a sponsor. You know, I have a really good life. I'm married to this wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a wonderful wife. I have these two beautiful kids. I will say, I think there's a little misrepresentation in Alcoholics Anonymous about kids, because people will be like, oh, my kid in here, my kid there. It's like, kids are a giant pain in the ass, you know? I mean, I was like, they are so easy to make and so hard to take care of. I swear to God, I couldn't believe it. And I absolutely believe I was meant to be a father to these two girls, but man, it was hard work. And one of them turned out, like her sophomore year in high school, her head just spun around and she just turned into this other monster. And I was under the impression that I could love the alcoholism out of my kids. And it turns out not so much, you know, because I am a good father. I may not be a lot, but I'm a really good father. And she became this alcoholic. And at 19, we had to kick her out of the house. And it was just heartbreaking. Anybody who's been through it knows. I had never been through anything like it. I mean, it was just unbelievable. She was living in her car and living on the streets, and she got beaten up and her car stolen, and then she ended up being willing to go to a rehab. And she, she's 18 months sober now. And, again, it's one of those things where oh, thank you, that's sweet. I got a little golf clap. No, I'm just kidding. I said she's 18. No, I'm just kidding. But here's the truth of the matter is I would talk to her when I was on the way up here today, and we're both just trying to put in another day of sobriety. You know, I'm grateful for a lot of things. I'll say this and I might shut up. Maybe I'll go on. We'll see. But I thought, what am I the most grateful for? Because I'm grateful for a lot of things. You know, I have a really good career. I was teaching school in sobriety, and then I got this incredible offer to go be in the mortgage business, and I prayed to God, like, God, should I keep helping severely handicapped kids, or should I go after money? And then God said, screw those kids. And that's what I said. I was like, thy will be done, Father, you know, but no, I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm in the same business as Robert, so we're both just evil bankers, but evil mortgage brokers. Sorry, I didn't mean to out you there. But anyway, so I have a great life. I have a great life, but I thought, what am I the most grateful for? And I thought of these three things, and I'll say them and I'll sit down, probably. But the first thing I'm the most grateful for is my physical sobriety. Like, I'm really grateful that just today, that just Saturday, April 23rd, that I'm not putting anything in my system that affects me from the neck up. I know that that's an unnatural state for me. That's an unnatural state for any of us. And it doesn't mean, you know, I'm grateful for that I have long-term sobriety, but I'm grateful that just today I'm not battling the obsession to drink and losing. Because there's plenty of people, we all know them, who are out there right now, who were here with us last week. You know, and I'm thankful that, because that could be me, it could be my daughter again, you know, but I'm really grateful for that. I don't ever want to lose sight of that, you know, and I maintain that by coming to meetings and doing actions that are against my nature. And the second thing I'm the most grateful for is how I feel in my own skin most of the time. I remember what it was like, that feeling I had growing up, that angst, like wanting to just rip my skin off, and I remember what alcohol and other things did for me to make me feel better temporarily, and I don't feel that way anymore. If you're new, I felt uncomfortable and at dis-ease for a long time in sobriety. So don't feel like, oh, am I doing something wrong? It was a long time before that changed. But I feel comfortable in my own skin today as a result of the steps and of God, and I'm grateful for that. And the last thing I'm the most grateful for is, you know, this purpose we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, this, you know, this fellowship we have. You know, there's people I see up when I come up here sometimes I don't see very often. There's people I feel genuine love for and a connection to. I don't even know their last name, you know. I feel this camaraderie and this love, and I, you know, and there's people who will come in here next week, be broken just like I was in every single way, shape, or form, and we'll help put them back together, and they'll become useful, productive members of our society and society as a whole. And I, you know, I feel extremely lucky to be a part of that. Now, if you're new and if you can't stop drinking and your life isn't working anymore, I wish those three things on you more than anything else. So thanks, let me share.